Ephesians chapter 5, verses 15 to 20.
Be very careful, then, how you live, not as unwise, but as wise, making the most of every opportunity, because the days are evil. Therefore, do not be foolish, but understand what the Lord's will is. Do not get drunk on wine, which leads to debauchery. Instead, be filled with the Spirit, speaking to one another with psalms, hymns, and songs from the Spirit. Sing and make music from your heart to the Lord, always giving thanks to God the Father for everything in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ.
So the passage we've heard starts with a really simple command. Be careful how you live, not as unwise, but as wise. It's very simple, very easy sermon to preach. Live wisely, everybody. On you go. Can we have the slides up? There should be another. Yes. So this is how we do wisdom in 2017. We see something like this on Facebook or Twitter or whatever it is that I'm not cool enough to be on. It's a quote that we've deemed to be profound, plastered across the face of somebody we've deemed to be profound. And we pass that on. We repost it. We share it. And we send it out into the world. You can leave it. It should cycle automatically. Sometimes it's not a face, sometimes it's a sunset, sometimes it's a galaxy. I think it depends exactly what sort of point we're trying to get across. But you get the point. Here's the problem with this kind of wisdom, though. We don't know what its purpose is. We're taking it out of context. Actually, it doesn't appear to be moving, and I do need the next one. Are we moving? So there's a Steve Jobs quote coming up in a second. Taking it out of context, you would think that he was a starving artist. He doesn't care about making money. He just cares about making something wonderful. And we find that inspiring, and we pass that on. But what's he talking about? He's talking about making Apple products, which, last time I checked, were sold for money. Actually, quite a lot of money. And out of context, you lose that. The wisdom, the purpose is lost. What about the Gandhi quote? Ignoring why Gandhi said it, when my mate Terry puts it on his Facebook feed, why is he doing that? Is he really encouraging me to change how I live? Or is he encouraging me to think, hey, Terry's a deep guy. He knows about Gandhi. Is he virtue signaling? Probably, right? My favorite example, actually, is the Taylor Swift stuff. Some of you might know this already, and some of you might just be very familiar with her collected works. But two of the three quotes on here are things that she never said. They're not from the mind of the creative genius that brought you We Are Never, Never, Ever, Ever Getting Back Together. They're actually quotes from Adolf Hitler. People were sharing these. This was how the internet amused itself for a couple of months a few years ago. People were sharing these because if you think it's a quote from an inoffensive American country singer, it means one thing. If you know it's from one of history's most evil men, it means something very, very different. Context matters. We can go back to the reading now. We don't need Taylor staring over us for the rest. The wisdom that we're looking at today is solid, practical thinking about how to live, that the Apostle Paul was passing on to new churches, new believers, primarily in Ephesus, and from them on to us. And the important thing about this wisdom is we are absolutely clear about its context. We know exactly what Paul is trying to do with this, and we know that because he tells us. In verse 8, just before this reading, Paul tells the believers that we were once in darkness, but now we're light in the Lord, and we should live as children of light. That's the context. That's what this advice is provided for. Because of what God has done for us through Jesus, we're different. Our old ways won't do anymore. We need new ways. That's the reason why he's presenting us with these new ways. It's not morality. It's not good behavior for good behavior's sake. It's our reaction. It's our new behavior born out of God's grace to us. There are three aspects to wisdom in the passage that we're going to look at. Be sharp, be sober, and be spirit-filled. There's note sheets on the table. Let's take those in turn. So first, verse 16. We're to live making the most of the opportunity. I'm a big fan of looking at other translations for context. The King James Version translates this beautifully. We're to redeem the time. We should redeem the time. In the original Greek, that's a merchant's phrase. It's something that refers to planning your business so that you're making the most possible profit out of your efforts. Its modern equivalent, I suppose, would be don't just work hard, work smart. That's the advice that we're being given here. Now, Paul clearly isn't talking about our business lives. Paul's suggesting that in our work for the Lord, in our evangelism, in our discipleship, we should be trying to get the maximum return on our efforts. A friend of mine drives a black cab in London, and he has got this absolutely nailed in his business. He knows where the events are. He knows when they let out. He knows the right times to be on the right streets, in the right areas, to pick up the high-value fares that are going out to Heathrow or where he can pick up another fare quickly once he's dropped off. He also knows when to get his cab cleaned, when to get it serviced, when demand will be low, and he can relax at home knowing that he's not missing out on the money that he needs to live on. I would be a dreadful cabbie. I would be out at all hours, desperately trying to avoid missing a fare. And when something started rattling, or when somebody was sick, or whatever it is, I would be straight into the garage to get it fixed, to get it cleaned, and miss out on where all the money is. He's not like that. He redeems the time. The way that he spends his time is rewarded with maximum efficiency. He gets maximum results for every minute that he puts in. That's what Paul's encouraging us to be like. He's encouraging us to think about our work for the Lord in the same way, to be sharp, like good businessmen, to put in the planning so that we can get the best return on everything that we do. That was what the discussion was about earlier, in case that connection hadn't come through. And if your discussion was anything like ours, what we mostly talked about around the table was what aspects of the calendar year present opportunities for evangelism? What times in the calendar present us as a church with the opportunity to get out there and say, hey, here we are. You're thinking about these things anyway. Come and hear more. Christmas, Easter, we were talking about harvest and various other times where there's an obvious route, an obvious connection for evangelism. I'll give you another example of things that we do at church level. You'll have noticed that when we run Christianity Explored courses, they're normally timed for just after we've been very visible in the community, whether that's at Bulldog Fair or at one of those times, Christmas or Easter and things like that. The amount of effort that we put in to run those courses is the same whenever we run them. Somebody has to teach, somebody provides meals, people host. That is a constant. But we do them when we think there will be more demand. We do them when we think people will be coming through the door so that we can get maximum return. That's being sharp. That's good practice. In our own personal work for the Lord, though, are we being as sharp? Are we planning? Are we doing the right things at the right time? Or are we doing the same things all the time? Are we making time to learn the Bible and making time to learn new ways of explaining it, as well as getting out there and doing it? Are we developing new friendships in the church, new friendships in the world, as well as supporting our existing friends, as well as witnessing to our non-Christian friends? Are we recharging our batteries, as well as spending our energy getting out there and doing? Are we being nurtured, as well as nurturing? Redeeming the time, making the best of our opportunities, requires that we plan, because the days are evil. They're no less evil now than they were then. The world isn't going to do us any favours. When opportunities present themselves, we need to be ready. And we can't then not be prepared because we haven't planned. We can't fail to have been nurtured, fail to have recharged. We need to get the maximum impact for God out of the effort that we put into his work. We need to be sharp. Next, be sober, verse 18. Do not get drunk on wine, which leads to debauchery. It's actually a very difficult verse, in part because it looks really easy, right? We see that word drunk, and we think, well, that means somebody staggering down the street, weaving from side to side, little X's for eyes, being sick in a bin. Don't do that. Box ticked. Move on. But I don't think it's quite that simple, is it? And of course, it's not as simple as saying, don't ever drink. Later on, Paul, who is writing this letter, writes to his friend Timothy, and he encourages him to drink wine, in fact, to settle his stomach. Jesus himself encourages the apostles to drink at the Last Supper. And the Old Testament is full of descriptions of wine and its goodness, comparing that to the goodness of God. So it's not don't drink. And although, yes, we are to avoid being cartoonishly sloshed, it's not just that. It's more. So look at the verse again. Don't get drunk because it leads to debauchery. Debauchery means the opposite of restraint. Debauchery means indulgence. Debauchery means giving in to sensation, giving in to the world and the flesh, rather than keeping focused on the things of God. What Paul's telling us here is that we should avoid drinking, not just to the point where we're blackout drunk, but to the point where we lose sight of our judgment, to the point where we lose sight of what is good, and go after what feels good. He's telling us not to compromise our judgment. This point actually is made elsewhere in the Bible as well. In Leviticus 10, where they're laying down the rules for the priests, they are told that when they're on duty, they can't drink. And it's made explicit that that's because their role is to distinguish between holy and common, between clean and unclean. And if they're drunk, if they're drinking, they're not going to be able to make those judgment calls accurately. So we're not just talking about them not showing up for work because they're hungover. We're talking about them having had a couple and being there and making the wrong call. Their judgment is compromised. That's what's forbidden. Later on in Paul's letters, when he writes about how to select church leaders, among other things, he says to avoid selecting leaders who are prone to drunkenness. Again, in a role where judgment is key, in a role where clear judgment is called for, drinking is a problem. Not just getting excessively drunk, but drinking is a problem. And if we're honest with ourselves, we know this from the world around us. We talk about people being under the influence, right? I mean, that's the phrase that gets used. Even without getting to the point that we're all picturing of the cartoonish drunk, we know that behaviour changes when people are drinking. Think of all the things which are blamed on having had a couple. A huge amount of marital infidelity, traffic accidents, fights in city centres, vandalism. These are the obvious examples of what Paul is warning us about here, that debauchery. People putting aside civility and good behaviour and chasing after what feels good in the moment. But it's not even just the big obvious things. Think how many ridiculous arguments have been had with at least one person having had a few. Think how many unkind remarks have been made under the influence. And for anybody who's been a Christian and gone through university and starting their careers and things along those lines, think how many times people have joined in with conversations in the pub that if they'd been having in the living room, they'd have backed away from or said, this is not appropriate. That's what we're talking about. If our aim is to be children of light, that has to extend to every aspect of our lives. And our conversations are not exempt. We shouldn't drink to the point where we're smashed. No, that's clear. But it's more than that. We should keep our judgment intact. We should behave as we know we should. And if drinking's going to cause us a problem with that, that's the point we should stop. We should be sober. Finally, be spirit-filled. Verse 18 to 20 tells us that instead of getting drunk on wine, we should drink deeply of the Spirit. This is phrased as a command, so clearly it's something that Paul intends we should do, that the Christians in Ephesus could do and that we as Christians now can do. So what it doesn't mean, what it clearly doesn't mean, is receive the Spirit. Because we know this happens at conversion. So what is he saying? Verse 19 suggests, for a start, that it means being with other Christians. Paul tells the Ephesians to speak to one another, to other believers. He also tells them to speak in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. Of course, this letter was written before there was a Bible, in the way that we think of it today. A lot of the Old Testament had been collected, maybe not all of it, but the New Testament writings that would translate that into Jesus' life for Christian believers were still being written, and even those that have been written were letters. They'd been sent to churches, they were passed around perhaps, but there was no great collection of them. The way that gospel truths were passed around in early churches was psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. In case anyone's curious, no scholars know what the difference is between those three things, but there is quite a lot of writing trying to figure it out. Paul probably doesn't mean that Christians should constantly sing at each other, or even just recite lyrics, which will be a relief to anybody who stood in front of me on a Sunday morning. He's probably reminding them to keep those truths central. This is the way that they had of passing those truths on. And he's encouraging them to keep them central to their congregation, to dwell on them, to study them, to encourage one another in the words of those fantastic gospel truths. For us, we're spoiled for choice. We have the Bible, and we have the psalms, the hymns, and spiritual songs. We have so many ways in which we can obey this and we can apply this wisdom to our lives. So many ways in which we can encourage each other if we make the time to do it. So yes, singing is still a part of that. But now also, studying directly can be part of that too. Then at the end of verse 19, Paul says that being spirit-filled means that we should sing and make music in our hearts to the Lord. Again, this is a product of its time. In Paul's culture, singing was the main form of worship. Throughout the Bible, particularly the Old Testament, but in the New Testament as well, thinking of Mary as a prime example, people sing their praises when they respond to God. It's through the medium of song that they do it. So when Paul says that our hearts should sing to the Lord, he means that we should be praising God in our hearts, internally, all the time. Might that sometimes take the form of song? It certainly does for us on a Sunday after church when we've sung one in the morning we like. We all independently will be walking around the house whistling. But that's not necessary. That's not what it has to be. The point is that we should be praising, that we should be thankful. So being filled with the Spirit, is a command. And I think the command is to make sure that we're paying attention to the truths of the gospel and to make sure that we're praising God. In other words, to get out of the way and let the Spirit that we know we have in us do his work. That is part of his work. He will help us if we set out to do those things. Again, this is practical advice in our attempts to be children of light. Focusing on the gospel, focusing on God, allowing the Spirit, who is God in us, to do his work. That's crucial. We need to be Spirit-filled. So those are the three aspects of wisdom that are in the passage. Be sharp, be sober, and be Spirit-filled. It's intensely practical. This is designed from ground up to be lived, not just to be known. This isn't knowledge. Like the saying goes, knowledge is that a tomato is a fruit. Wisdom is not putting it in a fruit salad. It's practical stuff. It's designed to be done. Plan your time for maximum effect in your Christian work. Stay away from anything that's more likely to make you slip up. Spend more time with things that will help you keep going. When you boil it down, it's pretty simple. But that's not to say that it's easy. We've all slipped up on these things. We've all gotten our planning wrong, or just failed to plan entirely. And as a result, we've all seen an opportunity slip by. We've all seen something come up at a time when we just didn't have the energy or didn't have the know-how to go for it. We've all failed at times to make God's word central to our relationships with other believers. We've all failed to spend the right amount of time dwelling on the things of God or praising God in our hearts, even in the bad times. And, of course, many of us, I won't say all of us, have drunk to the point where our judgment was compromised, and we've said that thing we shouldn't have said, or we've done that thing we shouldn't have done. This is all wisdom. It's all practical help towards our goal of living as children of light. But on our own, we can't even take the steps on that journey. That's what's so total about our need for God's grace. He saves us, and even though we want to respond, we can't even do that. What's so marvellous about God's grace, though, is that even then, he helps us. In James's letter, chapter 1, verse 5, it says this: if any of you lacks wisdom, you should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to you. So yes, be sharp, be sober, be spirit-filled. This is all practical advice to help us live the way we know we ought to. And we should do those things as best we can. We can't do it on our own, but we should at least aspire to. But above all, in the words of verse 20, we should give thanks always and for everything to God the Father in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. Because ultimately, it's his grace that calls us, and his grace that can give us the wisdom we need.